This is how we do it.
If Superman's grounded, leave it to Ajax. Cause we're so fly, we're making your next snap. With the podcast that rocks all the nation. Here we got the future of comic race relations. Play the phonogram if you're feeling alright. Cause we're chilling with the hand and we're staying out of sight.
Alright.
That's the way Ajax breaks the silence. With Chris Sims writing that Comics Alliance. Please, so delirious, we take it so serious. And Adam's got the skills you can't fathom like Mysterious. So turn up your stereo, brush off your shoulders. Us against the world like Scott and Ramona. Yo, we got the power, just feel the Kirby crackle. Big ups to Max Huffman and Rusty Shackle. And if you're feeling this, you got the resurrection. Cause we're busting out the panels of your comic book collection. If Flash Gordon dies before I wake, I send the War Rocket Ajax, killing him anyway. Roll through every podcast, murder the DJ. Rolling on the internet, WRA. If Flash Gordon dies before I wake, I send the War Rocket Ajax, killing him anyway. Rolling every podcast, murder the DJ. Rolling on the internet, WRA.
Let's go. But inconspicuously.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax number, I believe this is number 48. We're closing in on the half century mark. My name is Chris Sims, and normally this would be the part of the show where I introduce my co-host Eugene On with the words, "With me as always is my co-host Eugene On," but that is no longer the case. So please allow me to introduce new co-host, Mr. Matt Wilson. How's it going, Matt?
Surprise! I'm sure it's not a surprise to anyone who has listened to all the shows I've been on that I'm going to be taking over for Eugene. Listen, here's what happened. The people spoke, and we heard what they had to say. And what the people said was, we want more white male comedy writers from the Carolinas on War Rocket Ajax. And we responded. You got what you wanted, people.
Yeah, if we could have someone else who used to write for Cracked,
yeah,
that would be great.
We'll get into all of that, like how you and I know each other and sort of how I ended up doing this maybe later on in the show. But yes, if you were looking for another white dude who reads comics, who's from the Carolinas and writes comedy on the internet.
And doesn't rap.
And who doesn't rap. Eugene and I were talking about theme songs and how he's going to continue doing our theme song announcement, everyone. But if he didn't, then I would be doing the theme song, and it would either always be a cappella Bombs Over Baghdad or me just singing Private Eyes by a Hall & Oates.
I would fully support that.
Yeah.
As everyone it may knows, come to that. I am a proponent of Hall & Oates in all their forms.
Yeah. Eugene and I had a long conversation about how we unabashedly and unironically love Hall & Oates, and anyone who thinks otherwise can suck it.
Yeah, like, Hall & Oates is really good, or are really good, I guess I should say. I'm using them as a collective, but, I mean, this is probably, like, the intro of the show is probably not the place to be saying all this, but, Portable Radio is, like, a legitimately, like, really awesome, peppy pop song, and Rich Girl?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Rich Girl is just amazing.
Here's all I'll say, and we'll close out our conversation about Hall & Oates. I recently got a TV that's one of those internet TVs that has, like, YouTube apps on it and Hulu and Netflix and that kind of stuff. The first thing I went to when I was able to have YouTube on my TV was to watch some Hall & Oates videos.
All right. And with that, welcome to War Rocket Ajax number 48.
Yes.
If you'd like to find out more about the show, you can still check us out at warrocketajax.com. You can still email the show at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. You can still follow us on Twitter. You can still follow Huge on Twitter at HugeWarrock, but we'll give all that information out at the end of the show.
Yes, we will.
What do you say we just go ahead and move on into checking ourselves?
Let's do it, Chris. So come
on. All right, here we are with Check Yourself. Matt, let's check in with you, see what's going on.
Well, I guess the big news this week is that with little fanfare, at least to begin with, I have become the new co-host of War Rocket Ajax. Here's what happened. Eugene, as he said in a previous episode, I think had plans to finish out the year as the co-host of the show, and then he booked, like, 100 concerts.
Which is great.
which is awesome. I'm so glad that he's got that going on. But it sort of made it advance the timeline a little bit and made it so that my coming on as the producer and co-host of the show sped up a little bit. So anybody listening right now, if the quality of the editing or the recording or anything else sounds weird and terrible, it's
the
because
rapping.
Yeah, it's because you know, this is kind of my first go at it. I've done some sound editing stuff before, but you know, I'm obviously going to have a learning curve here, so please be forgiving with me. Also, I'm a little bit drunk, so.
In grand War Rocket Ajax tradition.
Yeah. Earlier tonight, I stopped in at the local liquor store that I go to sometimes, and they were having just like a tasting, not just of wine, but beer. I tasted scotch. They gave me a free glass. And now
I've never been to a scotch tasting.
Well, it was just one kind of scotch. It was Dewar's 12-year-aged scotch, which was okay. But I got a free glass out of that, which was made that worthwhile. And now I'm drinking a White Russian, and yeah, it's the editing I will hopefully do when I'm not a little drunk. But recording this a little bit drunk, you're just gonna have to live with that, guys. So live with it. What's going on with you, Chris?
Mostly what's going on with me is that I have been playing video games, as usual.
Hey, I do that too.
And today, actually just now, about an hour ago, I finished up Castlevania Lords of Shadow. And as longtime War Rocket Ajax listeners will be aware, I have a storied history of the Castlevania franchise. It's one of my, like, the Mega Man series, Grand Theft Auto, and Castlevania are like the three franchises that I've just, and I guess the Mario games too, are the games that I've just been, you know, completely enamored with for my entire career of playing games. But the rule with Castlevania for a long time, since Castlevania 64, has been that only the 2D side-scrolling Castlevania games are any good. That's why I only played the ones on Game Boy or Game Boy Advance and DS for a long time. But, you know, I played a little bit of Lament of Innocence on the PS2, but the Lords of Shadow, I actually was going to skip until I was on another podcast to talk about my love of Castlevania, and they recommended it to me. I've never played God of War, but I understand that it is a God of War clone.
That is my understanding as well.
What's that?
That is my understanding as well. Today, I actually watched the Zero Punctuation review of that game.
Uh-huh.
Which dubbed it a God of War clone, and also said there are Shadow of the Colossus elements in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Again, another game that I never played, but
yeah.
I was sort of aware of it, and so when you start climbing around on giant monsters that are, you know, 100 feet tall, then yeah, I can totally see that being a comparison. I actually liked the game a lot. It's the platform elements are actually really good, which is something that's usually really hard to pull off in a 3D game. Because there's, you know, a lot of margin of error for the player to, you know, press up and to the left instead of up to jump across a gap or whatever. But they're actually really good. There's a lot of time-wasting elements in the game. Like, you can't just hit a switch. Like, you have to hit a switch and hit it, like, 8 times in a little quick time event. And if you don't like QuickTime events, this is not the game for you. But it is the graphics are absolutely beautiful. I think it's the first game that I've played entirely, like start to finish, on my HDTV. And it's just a gorgeous game. The combat's really fun, except that you will buy plenty of, you know, you use your experience points to level up all your combat moves and get new moves that you'll never use. Because, you know, you can just stand there and beat monsters to death with whips. there is a castle. There are vampires. There is no Castlevania. There is no Dracula. And that was really a sticking point with me, because you know how I like Dracula.
Oh, you like Dracula, Chris? Because you've never mentioned it before.
I do. I love Dracula. He's the best public domain character.
He really is. Another thing that I've heard about this game, though, and you might be able to verify this, is that the writing is,
I would use the word atrocious.
Atrocious. That's what I was going to go for.
The story makes absolutely no sense, and that's actually one of the things I want to talk about. I'm going to spoil the ending of the game.
Go right ahead.
If anybody doesn't want to hear this, just skip ahead about 10 minutes. But this, you know, I'm totally going to spoil it because it has the weirdest... I did not think it was possible for a game to make less sense than Bayonetta. But it does. The game, you're Gabriel Belmont. It's a retcon of the Castlevania franchise, so you're the first Belmont. No longer is Leon Belmont the first Belmont. And so the game's sort of all about you going through, and you have this weapon called the Battle Cross, I think it is, Combat Cross maybe, that over the course of the game, it earns its nickname of Vampire Killer, which of course is the name of the Belmont's whip.
And that awesome song from the first Castlevania game.
Yes, a great song. And they also say Bloody Tears at one point, which is the name of another song.
Nice.
And I will say, like, as a fan of the franchise, there was a lot of stuff in there that was a nice little nod to different parts of Castlevania history. Like, there's a level that takes place in Weigel Village, which is the sort of home base village from Order of Ecclesia. There's, you know, a lot of neat stuff like that. But the story itself makes no sense. You're a member of this monastic order, this order of fighting monks called the Brotherhood of Light. You're hunting down the three Lords of Shadow, who, it turns out, are, like, when the three founders of the Brotherhood of Light ascended into heaven and became pure good, they left all their evil on Earth, and they became, you know, these pure evil monsters, which is kind of cool. That part of the story I don't have a problem with. The end of the story, after you beat Satan to death with your whip, and the crazy god mask that's supposed to turn you into God turns out to not do really much of anything at all, and then you get a cutscene, and this is the spoilery part. At the end of it, there's a cutscene where the Patrick Stewart character goes into this, you know, kind of classic Castlevania looking place, and he goes, and you think he's talking to Dracula, but he's actually talking to Gabriel Belmont, who has become Dracula. Through, like, reasons I do not understand and will I guess, be explored in the inevitable sequel. And then
One could assume that the god mask turned him into Dracula, maybe.
Yeah, except that there's nothing at the end of the actual game. Like this all happens after the credits. Like, there's nothing before the credits that indicates this at all.
Ah.
And, you know, it takes place in the year 1079, and, like, at the end of the game, you're just like, well, I guess I've freed all the souls that were trapped on Earth, and now they can go to heaven. The end. And then cut to this post-credit sequence. You find out Gabriel is Dracula. He's apparently a vampire now, because at one point he tries to bite the Patrick Stewart character. Patrick Stewart throws him through a window, and then he's in modern times. He's like in New York today.
So it's like they mixed the ending of, like, or reversed the ending of Evil Dead 2.
Yes!
And, like, decided, since it's a Konami game, they had to throw, like, a Metal Gear kind of thing in there. It's like the Castlevania equivalent of Revolver Ocelot on the phone with somebody and then ending his ridiculous phone conversation with Mr. President.
Yeah, it makes, like, I assumed this was going to be, I mean, I knew going into it that there was going to be, you know, that, oh, this is just the first game in a new Castlevania franchise. And I'm fine with that. I like Castlevania games. I will play one if you put it in front of me. But the Castlevania game that ends with the main character, like, a sudden thousand-year time jump, where apparently a lot of shit has gone down, none of which is mentioned. And then the Patrick Stewart character talks about how Satan's coming back, and that he and Gabriel have to team up to fight Satan. Also, the Patrick Stewart character turned out to be evil. before the credits. So it makes no sense at all. And I have I have no desire to play like a Castlevania game that involves me, like, you know, a Castlevania game in a modern setting is okay, because, I mean, we've seen that with Dawn of Sorrow and Aria of Sorrow, which were set in 2035. But right. They were set in Castlevania, where there's, right. You know, a castle full of monsters. Like, I have no desire to not go to Castlevania and fight Dracula. That is what I want to do out of those games. When they made Sonic the Hedgehog games that stopped being about running fast and getting rings, those games were terrible.
Yes.
So,
I guess you could take it this as some kind of like origin of Dracula and Castlevania, but in the most confusing, weird way that they could possibly make it happen.
I have no idea if the next game is going to be like set in 2011, and you're Gabriel Belmont / Dracula trying to fight Satan in modern times. Or if it's going to be set in, like, 1080, and you're going to be Gabriel Belmont going to Castlevania and somehow becoming Dracula. I have no idea, like, if it's a crazy flash-forward, if it's a crazy epilogue, if it's a prologue for the next game. It just makes, like, it doesn't really ruin the game. It completely ruins the game's story. I do think it's a highly enjoyable game. I enjoyed the gameplay. I do not regret purchasing it. But, man, what a kooky, ridiculous story. And also, he's the first Belmont, and you're trying to bring his wife back to life, which I assumed you would do, because if he's the first Belmont, then there have to be other Belmonts. But he does not bring his wife back to life. She stays dead, so...
I guess he's got a brother who...
Or maybe he gets married again. I don't know, but...
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Thumbs
down to Castlevania Lords of Shadow's ridiculous story. That's what I say.
The Zero Punctuation Review mentioned the portal joke in the game and how it's just shoehorned in there and, like, 2 years too late.
Yeah, like, you... one of the things in the game is that you are always finding... I actually liked this. This was a pretty cool mechanic. You're always finding, like, the bodies of other members of the Brotherhood of Light that have gotten to this point before you and died. So, you know, and then all of them have either items that you can take, or they have little scrolls that tell you, like, what was going on. Some of them are really well written. You know, all of them are weird, you know, like, that they would write this down right before they died.
Yeah.
Like, that they would take the time to write all this. But some of them are really well written. And then there's one that, out of nowhere, just ends with, you know, haha, the cake is a lie, or... And it's, like, it makes no sense. Like, why did you put that in there?
The only explanation is if someone traveled back from, like, 2009 and became a member of the Brotherhood of Light and was a big video game fan and was like, oh, shit, yeah, I get to go fight monsters with a whip. And then decided to slyly indicate his time traveler status in his note.
And then immediately died.
And then immediately die.
Which is... That needs to happen to people who are still making that joke. but it's not even like... You're not even in a bakery or anything. It's like I think it's in just some kind of random-ass dungeon. Like maybe a sewer or something. And it's like... there's no context for it. Like, there's no way for that... You can make that joke make sense in the proper setting. But right. In this game, it was just bad.
Well, we're on the topic of video games. I do want to give a quick update on Fallout New Vegas, which I'm continuing to play, and I'm finding more and more bugs and more things that are annoying about it, even though other parts of the game is still very good. My favorite moment in the game, and possibly any game ever, happened when I was playing a few nights ago. There is a mission/quest in the game where you are actually tasked with finding prostitutes for a casino to, like, kind of be their stable of prostitutes. And one of the prostitutes you have to find is just like a smooth talking guy. They just tell you, go find us a smooth talking guy. And there was a character that I had encountered earlier in the game who was obviously that smooth talking guy that I had to go recruit. So I went and I talked to him, and all it took was like saying two things to the guy before he got really, really excited about being a prostitute, thanked you, and ran full speed toward the casino to go be a prostitute. It was amazing. Like, just this, like, you go up to the guy, you ask him, hey, do you want to be a prostitute? And he goes, you bet! And she's busts. It is incredible. Oh, that alone made Fallout New Vegas worth it.
I do have one more thing about Castlevania.
Okay.
When you, so again, spoiler warning, if you skip to this point thinking you were done with the spoilers, you're not. At the end of the game, you find out, and this is obvious from the moment you meet him, that the Patrick Stewart character is evil. And while this was obvious to me, it was not obvious to Gabriel. And so when Patrick Stewart reveals that he is the king of all necromancers or whatever, Gabriel says, no, no, you're lying. And Patrick Stewart says, search your soul. You know it to be true. That was the moment I almost like popped the DVD out of the Xbox, send that back to Amazon.
You know, if anybody else had said that, you probably would have, but since it was Patrick Stewart. Yeah,
like, since it was Patrick Stewart, like, I can appreciate the humor of making that dude, like, of writing that down on a piece of paper, going to the, be like, hey, say this.
Which I assume
is how it was done.
Yeah, somebody just wrote it down on a post-it in the recording booth, in the recording studio, and handed it to him, because somebody else dared him to do it, and then Patrick Stewart just read it, and they put it in the game.
Yeah. Well, that is what I have been up to.
All right, and now we will then move on to our recommendations. What do you want to recommend to our listeners this week, Chris?
I actually have a lot of recommendations, but first, I have a recommendation that I am obliged to make. The Snakebite Company sent me for review a Wii controller that they made, and I believe the deal with this, the big deal that they made in the press release they sent me, was that this is the first third party Wii controller that has Motion Plus built in, and it retails for about $10 cheaper than the Nintendo Wii controller with the Motion Plus. I got Wii Fit for. Or not Wii Fit, Wii Sports Resort for my birthday. Our good friend Dr. K gave it to me for my birthday. And I love the sword fighting game. Uh-huh. I think it's awesome. But the Motion Plus that I plug into my Wii Remote, like, gets really jacked up when I do the sword fighting little challenge where it's basically the Wii Toshiro Mifune simulator where you're just running across a mountain just wrecking dudes with your sword, which is awesome. But they asked me if I would be interested in reviewing this one, so I said sure. So they sent it to me. I used it. I actually did find it to be much better at keeping the right motions than the Motion Plus that you plug into the regular Wiimote. I have not tried the regular Nintendo version that has the Motion Plus built in, but I did try the Snakebite. And like I said, it retails for about $10 less. I really enjoyed it, so thank you to those guys for sending it to me. If you're in the market for a Wiimote, I would say pick that one up. So that is our War Rocket Ajax paid announcement of the week. Not even
our
paid, they just sent me
sponsored announcement.
Nice. As for other stuff to recommend, stuff from people who are not giving me things, the new Girl Talk came out today this week.
Yes, it did.
And that was awesome.
As when this show airs, it will be a week ago. Today.
Yes. For those of you who aren't familiar with Girl Talk, Huge and I talked on the show before back in the good days. about how much we love mashups. I am a big mashup guy. And one of the first mashup albums I ever got was Night Ripper, which was the big, the first big Girl Talk album. And the deal with it is there's this guy, Greg Gillis, a.k.a. Girl Talk, and he does these mashups that are at most about 30 seconds long, but they all overlap. So he'll do like these, you know, 90-minute or you know, 60-minute, 70-minute albums that's all like constant changing as he goes through and mashes up everything. And it's rap, it's pop, it's like old music, it's soul, it's really good stuff. And a lot of people don't like it because it's so, it doesn't stay with any one thing long enough. But for me, it's like there's that moment in every mashup that you hear where everything just kind of comes together perfectly. It's only that moment for an album. And it's really, like, I really love the albums. And the new one, I don't even think it was it was Pay What You Want. I think it was just a free download.
Yeah,
right?
It was just free. It was just free. Yeah.
He did the Feed the Animals, which was his second album, as a Pay What You Want model. And if you paid, like, I think it was $10, you got the physical CD, too.
Yeah.
But this one was just a completely offered up as a free download. It's full length. It's called All Day. Which I assume he called it because he knew people were going to be like, man, I've been listening to that new Girl Talk album all day. The first track mashes up War Pigs by Black Sabbath, Move by Ludacris, and Empire State of Mind by Jay-Z. Like, that's how it starts. And it, like, it starts off with a pretty big high point. It just maintains really well through there. And my favorite moment is when he throws in Creep by Radiohead and Shimmy Shimmy Ya by Old Dirty Bastard. Because that moment is...
Yeah, that moment is amazing. My favorite moment, and I've been listening to it a lot too, I think I still prefer Feed the Animals to this one. At the very least, this one has a little bit of a learning curve, or at least a little bit of time that it takes to grow on you, at least at certain parts. Whereas his last two, Night Ripper and Feed the Animals, were sort of immediate. I listened to it, and I was like, oh man. This one had moments like that for me, but big stretches of me kind of not being completely interested. And now as I listen to it more, those stretches have kind of surprises in them that sort of reward me as I listen to it more often. But probably my favorite moment, and I might be the only person who thinks this, but probably my favorite moment is a tie between... Craig Mack's Flavor in Your Ear and GZA's Liquid Swords, that being mashed up. Liquid Swords is probably my one of my favorite hip hop beats of all time, and Flavor in Your Ear is a song I remember, like, I remember seeing that video on TV all the time and like really liking that song. So hearing those two together is awesome. And then the one that everybody is naming as their favorite, and with good reason, is Portishead, Sour Times, and Big Boy's Shutterbug, which is at the start of the fourth track on the album, and is incredible to hear those two together. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's. I think it's a really solid album. I don't know if it's as good as Feed the Animals, because Feed the Animals was easily my favorite album of last year. And this one's pretty solid, though. If you want to download it, you can find it at illegal-art.net/allday. That's A-L-L-D-A-Y. Or you can check out alldaysamples.com, which will actually stream it. And then as it streams, the artist that it's sampling will pop up so you can see it. It's a really neat thing.
That website is something else. Somebody put a lot of work into that. And it was up, like, the day after released the album.
Yeah, it was, which is really impressive.
Yeah,
and I actually don't know if it was Girl Talk himself who did it, or if it was just, you know, somebody, a really dedicated fan.
Yeah, either way, it took a lot to do it.
Yeah, and if you missed out, if you didn't get it the day it came out, don't worry, because nobody else could either.
Yeah, you can go to the Illegal Art website and download it now, but the day it came out, you could not get to that website. It was next to impossible to get the album from there. Like, but people were passing around links a lot, and there was a lot of torrenting of the album and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But
Actually, looking at alldaysamples.com, it is just a guy who's a fan, and he also did it for Feed the Animals. So, pretty cool ways that you can go in and check out these albums if you haven't downloaded them yet. But yeah, I love some mashups.
Yeah, me too. Anything else to recommend, Chris?
Yeah, I did have one more recommendation I wanted to make. Speaking of people taking existing elements and mashing them up in new and exciting ways, David Brothers, who's a writer over at Comics Alliance and Fourth Letter, told me about this game called Super Mario Brothers X. And like I said, you know, I rarely ever mention them among my favorite games because I feel like it's cheating because everybody has played and loves the Mario games. But this website, supermariobrothers.org, made a game called Super Mario Brothers X. And what it is it's all the elements from Super Mario World and the Super Mario All-Stars games, which were the 16-bit versions of Super Mario, Super Mario 2, Super Mario 3, and the Lost Levels, done up in one game that people, in one sort of engine that people can add things to make levels for, using all these different elements, plus elements from other games like Metroid and The Legend of Zelda. And you can play as Mario, Luigi, Toad, the Princess, or Link in these Mario levels. It's really, really cool. It's a hefty download, but you can check it out at supermariobrothers.org /SMBX. I downloaded it. The only problem I had with it was that it didn't want to recognize my gamepad that I have, but you can use any program that will translate your gamepad into keyboard strokes if you have anything handy. And so I just downloaded one of those and played it that way. And it's great. They've added stuff. They've created new power-ups. And it's obvious. They're obviously levels made by fans, because there's, you know, it's very clear that, you know, these are people who've been playing Super Mario World for 20 years and have been like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if we did this? But unlike a lot of things, you know, unlike a lot of amateur projects, this one actually has like a really great level of craftsmanship to it.
Now, is this the one where you can also play as Mega Man, or is that a different game?
No, that was a Flash game.
Okay.
That had Mario, Link, Mega Man, and Hayabusa from Ninja Gaiden.
Okay.
But this is like a full game that you can download. It comes with, it says it comes with 50 levels. I don't think that's quite true. I didn't count them, but it felt a little short. But you can also download different expansion packs for it. And it killed a lot of time this weekend and kept me from getting a lot of sleep. So I would definitely recommend checking that out. It's a pretty cool thing.
It's a big step up from the old ROM mods that you used
ROM
to be able
hacks.
To get. ROM hacks that you used to be able to get that would just kind of change the sprites in Super Mario Brothers. The one that I most clearly remember was called Super Bald Brothers, and all it did was just make the sprites bald, which was stupid, but on the other hand, brilliant. So.
Yeah, there's one level in this where you're, you know, kind of bopping around, and then you go down a pipe, and all of a sudden you're in Metroid, and there's Metroid monsters around, and also, you know, Koopa Troopas, and you get a cannon, and then you have to fight Mother Brain. So that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
Matt, what about you? What do you have to recommend this week?
I'm going to hesitantly recommend the Walking Dead TV series.
I notice you're hesitant.
You noticed that, huh? You picked up on my tone. There have been three episodes so far. I've watched them all. The pilot was just stellar.
Yeah, I actually watched that. And
the pilot was terrific. And
I was really impressed because it looked, I mean, for one thing, it looked really good for being a show on television.
It's all shot on 16mm film. It's not digital video like a lot of stuff is now, or videotape, which is what a lot of like live-to-tape TV is. It's real 16mm film, and it gives the show this kind of grainy, old-fashioned feel that is just perfect. It makes it look really good and very cinematic. The pilot episode had lots of really, really great moments that were frankly better than a lot of things you will see in even like a real zombie movie that's released in theaters. Just very high quality, very well directed. That pilot episode takes a lot from the first few issues of the comic and really makes it perfect for a TV show. Where it really kind of falls off is in the second episode. The second episode introduces a lot of characters who were not in the comic. And in a weird way, those characters who were not comic characters are considerably more one-dimensional than the characters on the TV show who were in the comic. There's one character in particular who's just sort of an outspoken racist who is clearly in there only to create conflict among the people.
Now, is he racist against zombies?
No. Now, that I've seen before. No, he's just racist against a black guy. And it's very on the surface. It's, you know, he just basically says, you know, I hate you and I don't think you're as good as me, you know, to the guy, and they get into a big fight, and it's clearly in there just to create a complication, to make it so that they don't get out of the place they're trying to get out of, and to make it difficult. That second episode really took a dip in quality. The third episode really pulled it back up and did a really good job of even fleshing out that character who was so bad in the second episode. He's only in the third episode for one scene, but in that portion that he's in, he's very you get a sense that there's more to him than just kind of being a one-dimensional hick racist. So, you know, the show's showing a lot of promise. I'm going to keep watching it, and I hope it's more like episodes 1 and 3 than episode 2 was.
Yeah, and it's been a pretty big deal.
Oh, yeah, it's
I don't think we talked
ratings
about it on the show, but I think that first episode got, like, what, like 8 million viewers?
I think it's the biggest show AMC has ever had.
Yeah,
and
which,
AMC,
I mean,
has Mad Men, so.
and you know, more power to them. I mean, you know, working in a comic book store for as long as I did, I can tell you that for years, for a long time, you know, the comic that the comics that people who didn't read comics would read were you know, Watchmen, Dark Knight, and Sandman. Sandman Volume 1 only. They read that and were done.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, there's 10 more. There's 9 more, and they're better. but then, like, Walking Dead really, I mean, you know, the store where I worked had a pretty, I tried to run a pretty good graphic novel section, a pretty good trade paperback wall. There was not a week when I didn't have to reorder Walking Dead in the entire time I was working there. At least one of the trades. And we, you know, stocked them 2 and 3 deep and restocked them every week. So that was, you know, it's something, and again, that was in Columbia, South Carolina, which is not a big comics town. So there's, you know, to have that many people kind of tuning in and seeing this is really neat.
Yeah.
Especially if it, you know, drives them to stores to check out other stuff. Cause I actually, you know, I read Walking Dead for a while, but I think it's not Kirkman's best. I think there's a lot of, you know, I totally see the appeal. But I think, you know, Invincible, I think is better. So hopefully people will want to, you know, will not just be like really into this one thing and actually try and check out other stuff, which we have seen before they do not do.
Yeah.
But hopefully if, you know, if 1% of that 8 million does, then that's still going to be like, you know, a massive influx into comic book stores, as sad as that is.
There are definitely parts in the Walking Dead comic where it's clearly just spinning its wheels, that parts that seem kind of like padding just until Kirkman figures out the next thing to do, or just because it's sort of part and parcel of the zombie genre. I like the comic. I haven't read it in a while. I stopped. I kind of fell off of reading it around issue 70-ish, but I would still catch up with it. I like Invincible, too. I've been reading it completely in trades. But the TV show does a really good job, I think, of compressing some of the stuff from the comic that does feel like padding, while also sort of deepening the characters. The only issue that I have with it, as I said, is with some of the characters that, oddly enough, have been created specifically for the TV show and seem to only be there to have more people, either as cannon fodder or to pad out the show. So we'll have to see where it goes, but so far I've been impressed with all but that second episode. So I would recommend at least checking it out and giving it a try.
I hope that this episode that comes on this week is just awful and you look like a total jerk.
Well,
I don't hope that, actually.
Maybe it'll do a reverse of the Star Trek movies, and all the odd-numbered episodes will be good, and the even-numbered episodes will be terrible.
Could we'll be. And that's about all I've got for recommendations, so why don't we take a look at this week's comics?
Let's do it.
I have not read many of the comics from this week because I read Batman the Return and Batman Inc. number 1 and decided that nothing was going to be any better than that. So I read a couple of other things, and there's some stuff that I am definitely going to read. Thunderbolts number 150 came out, and Jeff Parker has been killing it on that book. I mean, you know, for God's sake, that's a book where the team's airplane is Man-Thing. Like, they don't have any transportation. They just go down to the basement to the nexus of all realities and teleport wherever they want with Man-Thing. That's awesome. And also, Spider-Girl number 1 came out, which is the Paul Tobin character formerly known as Aranya, the Anya Corazon character.
Yes.
Who doesn't have powers anymore, apparently. Apparently she lost her powers in Grim Hunt, a Spider-Man storyline I have yet to read, but I've heard good things about. And now she's just kind of, you know, kicking it, no powers, fighting crime, hanging out with Spider-Man, and having a Twitter feed. Because that's what the hip characters do these days.
That is what the hip ones do. Grim Hunt was good, except for the parts where they actually said Grim Hunt.
Yeah, I understand that the guy's name is Grim Hunter.
That is also true. But I can actually accept that more than a character just saying, this is the Grim Hunt,
yeah, that is,
which happens at one point.
Okay, there is a way to do that where you say the name of the storyline in the comic and have it be good. I mean, you know, 2 years, like, you know, a year after Batman R.I.P., when we actually got Dr. Hurt saying Batman R.I.P. in Batman and Robin 16, that was really good.
Yeah.
But, you know, that is difficult to pull off,
yes.
To say the least. You don't want to, you know, the fact that there have been characters who referred to House of M by its name in Marvel Comics was really like, oh man, remember when we were all trapped in the House of M? It's like, well, why are you calling it that? I mean, I know why we're calling it that, but like, oh, these secret wars we have are crazy.
And what about those secret wars too?
I guess these are the secret wars too. Yeah, it's like, oh man, how many Earths is this crisis raging on? So it's, you know, it's difficult to pull off, but I have heard good things about it. One comic I read before I got to the Batman comics was Superman 705.
Oh boy.
Which was the one I've been waiting for. This was the installment of J. Michael Straczynski's sure-to-be-a-classic story, Grounded.
Well, it's obviously going to finish, so...
The destined-to-finish classic, Grounded, where Superman fights... I believe the line in the solicitations and on the DC Universe blog was... an evil darker than the heart of space, the heart of man. that was actually, I don't know if those are the exact words. That might be better than what they actually said. But in this one, Superman, like, you know, it's got a kid in a Superman t-shirt with a black eye on the cover. So you know you're in for a good time. Superman helps out a kid whose dad is smacking him around. Now, I'm not going to say that this has no place in Superman comics, because I think you can do good Superman stories, good, you know, good superhero stories about these kind of serious subjects. Like, I mean, there's been a lot of stuff in the news lately about teen suicide, and look at look at All-Star Superman number 10. That's a phenomenal treatment of that subject that isn't it's in the middle of a big crazy superhero story, but it's not like disrespectful to it or cheap at all. This, however, if you go back and read Grounded, it is obvious that J. Mark Straczynski was like, well, everybody loves that scene in All-Star Superman, so I'm going to do stuff like that. And then he completely misses the point of all of it, because, I mean, think of the worst, most cliched, sort of hackneyed after-school special on the subject that you can think of, and this matches it far and away. My favorite bit was when Superman has a crazy dream where he's fighting monsters. And also, Superman's sleeping with Lois in a motel room, which I think is hilarious.
So, you know, Lois
Superman
is just
went and checked into a hotel.
Lois is just kind of following him on his walking trip, like taking taxi rides.
Yeah, like
as he goes.
Like, in theory, the way it's supposed to be going is that Lois Lane and Clark Kent are covering the story of Superman walking across the country. But, you know, I don't know if he changed back into Clark Kent and went and got into this hotel room, or if it was just Superman like walked up and was like, hey, can I get a room for the night? And then Lois had to sneak in. Which I would, you know, if they ever do like a Grounded Secret Files, I would like to see that story. But he's having this crazy dream where he's in this big fight, and when he wakes up, he's got his face is all scratched up and punched. He's got like a black eye from this crazy dream. What's going on? And then he goes and after the father, you know, shoves the kid down the basement stairs, Superman goes into the basement to save him. And so Superman's got the black eye and the kid's got the black eye, and the kid goes, does your dad beat you too? And that is the worst. I'm not going to say it's the worst thing I've ever read, because it's not even the worst thing I've read this year. But man, that's terrible.
Yes.
It's awful. It's just, I mean, it's like I laughed. I laughed hysterically when I read it, and I doubt that was what they were going for.
Well, you never know. But another thing that could be in the Superman Grounded Secret Files is whether he got his Philadelphia cheesesteak when he ordered it in, I guess it was 701. Like the absolute worst way to order a cheesesteak when you're in Philly. But
he's speaking, Superman. He treats Philadelphia with respect.
Yeah. Well, just like obviously JMS, and who's the artist on Grounded?
I believe it was Eddie Barrows, to start with. But I don't think this latest issue was by Eddie Barrows.
Well, whoever's doing the art, obviously they have great respect for the cities that Superman is visiting, because, I know in the episode or in the issue of Grounded, where he's in Philly, it's like supposed to be like Southeast Philly, and it's really like verdant and beautiful and green and like suburban homes in Southeast Philadelphia, which is just not so. And I saw some preview pages from 705, which is supposed to be set in Chicago, and which is my adopted home city. And man, just everything was wrong about, like, there's one part where he's in, supposed to be in Millennium Park, and he just like kind of walks away from the big concert area outside and the Bean, which is a big sculpture in Millennium Park. And he just goes and he sits on a bench right next to what I assume is supposed to be Lake Michigan. It's not like that at all.
Well, Matt, come on. It's not like there are maps and satellite footage that you can access for free from any computer in the world.
It's not like there's, Google Earth or, you know, lots and lots and lots of reference photos of Millennium Park that exist. I just, if Superman's going to walk across the country, shouldn't the country look like it looks? I just, that blows my mind. But I'm sure the people who are reading that story and loving it, you know, there's a suspension of disbelief that...
Do you think there are those people? Do you think those people exist?
Yes.
I would be surprised. I will say the art in this one actually is Wellington Diaz and Eddie Barrows with inks by J.P. Mayer and Eva Ferreria, excuse me. And one more thing about it before we put Superman 705 in the box forever is that the abused child, you know, his dad looks like Mike Hagar. Like, he looks exactly like Mike Hagar, which I find hilarious.
Does he wear, is he shirtless and in suspenders?
No, like, that would be the only thing. But he's got, like, Mike Hagar's hair, including the little part that kind of flops forward. And he's got the mustache.
Yeah.
And he look, like, he's this massive, like, you know, pro wrestler looking dude.
And he's the mayor of Chicago.
He's the mayor.
He's Richard M. Daley.
And what you don't, like, what JMS doesn't put in the script is that this kid is in the Mad Gear gang. There's no wonder.
Now, see, that's a comic I want to read.
But there's also his abused mother, who is, in typical comic book fashion, blonde, really skinny, large-breasted, and wearing a super tight pink t-shirt and what appears to be a leather miniskirt at all times.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's seriously.
Well,
could not
I will
be
say,
worse.
Chris, that is just how women in Chicago dress.
Okay, I didn't know.
It's a you know, we have cold winters, and in the summertime, it's all just leather skirts and tight pink t-shirts.
And since you moved there, I know you've grown a mustache and gained 150 pounds of muscle.
That's correct. I also. Beat up kids. So. Before we move on to the Batman comics, which I know we're both going to want to talk about, I take it you haven't yet read Amazing Spider-Man 648?
Was that the first part of Big Time or the second?
Yes, it was the first part.
Yeah, I did. I read it last week.
Okay.
We actually, no, we didn't review it on Comics Alliance. We talked about reviewing it on Comics Alliance. But yeah, I have read that one.
Okay. Well, I read it too this week, and you know, I liked it. I'm always a little hesitant about making Peter Parker have any luck at all, because a lot of times that leads to not very good stories. I remember back when they relaunched Amazing Spider-Man and Peter Parker Spider-Man, and they gave him back when John Byrne was on there. And they gave him the job at the lab where he was supposed to use his scientific knowledge. And in some ways, that this seems kind of like a retread of that. But
yeah, I mean, there is a job at a lab, and he uses his scientific knowledge.
Yeah, but it's done in every possible way better. For one thing, the characters who work at the lab are actual characters, and you could imagine them coming back and having some kind of, you know, place in a future story. You know, we'll see where Dan Slott goes with it, and now that Peter Parker has had a little luck come his way, whether it will be a help or a hurt. But, you know, I'm always a little iffy about a kind of story where Peter Parker moves into a really fancy apartment with his supermodel wife or moves into Avengers Mansion. But, you know, I'm certainly going to give this a try. And it's written in the same kind of fun, exciting way that the Brand New Day stories were written. So,
well, another thing about it, specifically the new job, is that it is clearly a new job that is coming with a lot of story hooks.
Yes.
Because all, like, it's Peter Parker and then, like, four mad scientists.
Yes.
Working in a lab. And I like that, you know, that's one of the things I like about Spider-Man, like, that I think is difficult about Spider-Man, too, is that his job at the Bugle, you know, allows him to go off and have adventures. You know, he just has to, you know, you have to have one panel of him webbing his camera to the wall and setting it up to explain, like, you know, it explains why Peter was there. It explains why Peter doesn't have office hours. It allows him to, you know, pay his bills by being Spider-Man. It accomplishes a lot of stuff and also opens the door for this really good cast of characters like Robbie Robertson, Ben Urich, Betty Brant, and of course, J. Jonah Jameson, the greatest Marvel character of all time. And I feel like that's what this job is going to allow him to do. Like, there's clearly Dan Slott put some thought into this and tried to create something that wouldn't just be a job.
Yeah. Well, there's even a part where the boss character says, "We don't care when you're here, or you don't punch a clock. We just want results."
Yeah, you can go be Spider-Man, wink, wink.
Yeah.
I did think there was a, you know, I was a little, like, slightly disappointed in the issue because I like Dan Slott so much. And I feel like he had to do a lot of introduction of, hey, this is what's going on now. And there's a lot of that book given over to sort of explaining what the status quo is to people who yes. would be jumping on.
There's clearly a part where it introduces the fact that J. Jonah Jameson's the mayor now.
Yeah.
You know, there's
and,
a lot
you know,
of...
There's, you know, let me go introduce myself to my girlfriend again. Let me go introduce myself to my supporting cast.
Yeah. And there's even the weird part at the beginning where it sort of introduces the fact that Spider-Man is part of the Avengers.
Yeah.
And there's no real reason for that part of the comic to exist except to kind of say, hey, Spider-Man's in the Avengers.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, if someone had never read Spider-Man before and you gave them this comic, they would know everything going on with Spider-Man right now. It has Spider-Man and the Avengers, it has Spider-Man getting a new job, Spider-Man getting a new place to live, Spider-Man talking to everybody in his life.
Yes.
J. Jonah Jameson talking to Robbie Robertson and getting the Daily Bugle back. It's got, you know, Dr. Octopus and basically all the Spider-Man villains sort of hanging out and talking to each other about each other.
It's got Aunt May and her husband, who is J. Jonah Jameson's dad, and introduces that relationship to people who don't know about it.
Yeah, and I gotta say, J. Jameson, that is the best, like, character punchline introduction in years.
Oh, it's great. It's
like Mark Waid knocked that one out of the park.
I love that two-part story where he's introduced. It is
perfect.
Terrific.
But yeah, you know, I enjoyed it. I think that now that a lot of that stuff's out of the way, it's only going to get better. Because I think Dan Slott, in a lot of ways, is best when he, not necessarily when he's introducing stuff that is already established. Like, he's really good at introducing stuff that he's coming up with. Like, if you read She-Hulk and The Thing, the character introductions and the situation introductions there are really good. And I feel like the best part of this issue was the introduction of Peter's new job.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I assume, since there's, you know, no more Spidey brain trust, that that's something Dan Slott came up with. And it's, you know, and it shows that that's what, you know, he's at his best introducing. But now that all the pieces are in place and you've sort of got everything set up, I think it's going to be a good run. I hope it is, because I like Spider-Man and I like Dan Slott a lot.
Yeah. So. The thing that I really hope for with that new job, and something that Slott kind of puts out there in this issue, is the idea that this job is going to be a lot of pressure for Peter, because there's kind of a demand that each of their like in-house geniuses comes up with something revolutionary and awesome every month.
Exactly. And I think that's cool.
Yeah.
I also like that this is a cast that clearly looks like it's going to see through all of Peter's bullshit.
Yes.
Like, there's, you know, the scene where, you know, something goes haywire with one of the machines and Peter has to go and fix it. By using his spider powers to sort of crawl along the floor, even though there's this big explosion that's pushing stuff away from it. And then he's like, yeah, I guess that explosion pulled me towards it somehow.
Yeah.
And all the scientists are like, that doesn't make any sense. Which I thought was fun, because it's, you know, I like the idea of Peter Parker secretly being the smartest guy in the room a lot of ways. And I feel like a lot of writers forget that.
Yeah.
Especially in team books, a lot of people forget that. I mean, Spider-Man's really smart. He's like, you know, he might not be like Tony Stark, Reed Richards smart, but he would probably be like the smartest person any one of us knows.
But he can hang with Tony Stark.
Yeah. Like Tony DeStark doesn't talk over his head.
Yeah.
Like Peter Parker would never build an Iron Man suit, but he would look at it and know how it works.
Exactly.
Which I think is something a lot of writers forget, and I think this is going to allow for a lot of that as well. I think it's going to be good.
Is this going to be a rotating artists like with Brand New Day, or is Umberto Ramos kind of?
I think Ramos is the ongoing artist. I would be really super surprised if we did not get fill-ins.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's twice monthly.
Yeah, I like Ramos's art a lot, but I can't help but kind of think about a lot of the art from Brand New Day and how good it was, and Marcos Martin and Paolo Rivera and those guys.
If we were getting Marcos Martin and Javier Pulido with like Paolo Rivera fill-ins, it would be it would easily be the book of 2011.
Yeah.
Because it would look beautiful. Dan Slott would, have artists who were like fully capable of drawing the best stuff out of his script. Because that's what, I mean, anytime any of those three guys are on that book, they just wreck it.
Yeah, I hope at least they bring in those guys for fill-ins, because that will be awesome.
Yeah, that would be great. And then we've got Batman.
Yep.
And I was talking to David Uzumeri, who does all the annotations of the Grant Morrison Batman books, earlier this week. And we were talking about how Batman Incorporated number one really feels like a new run. It's like Grant Morrison came on the book again for the first time. It's so different from his run on Batman. It's so different from his run on Batman and Robin. Mostly in that those were books about Gotham City in a lot of ways. And this, is clearly from this first issue. It's like the Denny O'Neil, Neil Adams 70s Batman, where he's, going around the world, fighting crime, taking his shirt off, getting laid, fighting crazy villains. I mean, it's essentially Batman as James Bond, going around the world, finding stuff out. And it's really fun. It's really action-packed, and it's really funny. It's probably, the funniest thing Grant Morrison has written since Sea Guy. There's so much comedy in it, not the least of which is built around Batman in his boxer shorts doing bench presses while Catwoman wanders around their hotel room in a bra, panties, and knee-high leather boots, which is pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
Because they're not part of her costume.
It is an altogether different tone than what he was even doing in Batman and Robin. And, Uzumeri has pointed out that the last arc of Batman and Robin was sort of a parody in and of itself of Batman RIP. But this is just kind of like a fun travelogue kind of story. And it's even got, a last page punchline that it sets up, earlier in the issue. And then there's also just the tease to the next issue, which is hilarious. And I don't necessarily want to give away what it is, but it's sort of a bit of an homage to the 60s Batman TV show.
Yeah, I mean, it might as well have said, same Bat comic next Bat month. It really should have. But at the same time, as funny as it is and as much as there's jokes, like it still does, feel like there's an element of danger to it. So it's very much, it's very much an adventure story, which is one of the things that I really love about Batman, is that you can do crime stories, you can do adventure stories, you can do, classic pulp style stories, classic noir style stories, you can do science fiction type stuff, you can have him travel through time and fight evil gods if you want to. And the beauty of Batman as the character he's evolved into is that he works in all that. So this is just very much a big classic adventure type story. And another thing that I really love about it is that the villains that Morrison writes, in this one we've got Lord Deathman, who comes from, this version specifically comes from the Jiro Kawada's Bat manga. The Batman stories that he did in Japan in the 60s, where he adapted a story by Robert Kaniger. But the Lord Deathman, the best thing about him is that you can clearly see he's a dude wearing a skull mask, because when the mask, the mouth on the mask opens up, you can see his actual mouth underneath it. And Yannick Paquette always draws him smiling and in these big, like, overblown poses. So there's this great theatricality to the villains, and that's something that we've seen Morrison do with the Joker, and we saw him do it with Dr. Hurt and the Black Glove. Like, there's that great part in Batman R.I.P. where if you read the dialogue with the emphasis on the bolded words, Dr. Hurt is just giving this amazing soliloquy that is just so completely over the top. And he's like, you know, the Black Glove at great expense has made certain documents available to the public. And the way he's standing there, and the way that we see Lord Deathman standing and the poses he's in, that Yannick Paquette does an amazing job with, is just so over the top and theatrical that, you know, you see why these guys are supervillains. You know, very much in the way, like on the Venture Brothers. They're not garden variety criminals. They're guys who are dedicated to villainy for its own sake, in the way that Batman is dedicated for justice. And I think that's really fun.
Yeah, and you mentioned pulp, and this also kind of has a pulpy feel to it. Like, you look at Mr. Unknown's costume, and it looks like he's a pulp hero from the 30s.
Yeah, he looks like the Black Terror.
Or the Shadow, or somebody like that.
Lord Deathman, I was thinking of looking like the Black Terror. Yeah, you're right. Mr. Unknown totally looks like, you know, he's got the fedora, he's got the tie. He totally looks like an old-style character.
The domino mask.
Yeah.
The cape where you can see where it's tied on. Like, it's got this real, like, throwback, pulpy feel to it, but in sort of like a winking, knowing way, like acknowledging that, you know, this is something readers have seen before, and but will also appreciate. And it's a very modern Batman who's doing all this stuff. So
yeah,
it's beautifully done.
When I was a kid, I always wanted to read those stories about the Club of Heroes, the Batman of all nations. And then when I was an adult and I finally got to go back and read those stories, like, I love that idea that, you know, there are other crime fighters that we don't necessarily see, but they've got these worlds, you know, their own worlds in the way that Batman has Gotham City. And Morrison has done something really good with that with Knight and Squire that Paul Cornell is also working on. And I love Paul Cornell's Knight and Squire series so far. But this, you know, takes that idea that was never really done that well in those old comics and then does it, you know, we get the big story. You know, the big story that's as big as it should be. And I think it's really great. The only thing that I wish is that Batman was wearing his real costume. Because I really want... I'm getting old, and I really want the gray and blue Jim Aparo, Neil Adams-style costume back. I do not like the current costume that that Bruce Wayne is in. I like it okay when Yannick Paquette is drawing it. It looks way better than I thought it was going to. But, you know, I think that's because Yannick Paquette's a really good artist. But I just don't like the raised bat symbol that kind of looks like an ashtray, and the fact that, you know, without the belt, it just looks like he's wearing a jumpsuit.
Well, however, acknowledging the fact that Batman, this version of Batman sort of is cool about hanging out in his hotel room with Catwoman in her underwear and getting laid, the codpiece makes a lot more sense.
It does have an extremely pronounced codpiece, which is kind of great. But I seriously, like, if the that's the one thing holding these comics back for me from being perfect, is if Batman had come back from being, you know, his crazy Return to Bruce Wayne adventure and been like, you know what, I want to put on my Jim Aparo suit, then I would be perfect with it. But I think it's a hoot.
You know, the other thing about this is you can really tell that this is a Bruce Wayne who's been through some stuff, and it has completely earned the change from him being, you know, dark, brooding, asshole Batman, the Miller Batman that everybody's been trying to write for the past 20-plus years, into a little bit of a more well-adjusted Batman with different goals and different ideas.
Yeah, I don't think anyone doesn't think I love Frank Miller's Batman. I mean, you know, Year One for years was my favorite story. Dark Knight is, you know, is one of the first comics that I read just over and over and over. And I can, you know, I can quote lines from both of those books constantly. But I feel like, you know, what's good about those books wasn't necessarily what a lot of people took away from them. And so many people have wanted to do that Batman because Dark Knight Returns is so good. They want to do their Batman just like that. And it's, you know, we've seen the Batman of 10 Nights of the Beast is exactly like that. The Batman of the Cult. And then as it goes on, you know, he gets darker. The point of Dark Knight Returns is that there needs to be a contrast. If, you know, Batman always acts like he does in Dark Knight Returns, then Dark Knight Returns has no impact. Then it's just, you know, Batman going out and being Batman again. The point of Dark Knight Returns is that Batman comes back and he's harsher.
Yeah.
He changes with his world. The prelude to Dark Knight Returns is not Year One. The prelude to Dark Knight Returns is Batman 66. You know, the world changes and Batman changes with it.
Yeah.
If he's always like that, it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, again, people, that's been the definitive Batman for so long. And I feel like Morrison is one of the few guys who's willing to go beyond just the Frank Miller stuff. And the way that he changes Year One in...
Oh, yeah.
In the Return of Bruce Wayne. Like, there is no way that Frank Miller intended for Batman Year One to be about Bruce Wayne reaching out and getting help. There is no way. And I know this because I've read other comics by Frank Miller. But, you know, the way that Morrison interprets that and brings that to, you know, to stuff like Robin and stuff like Nightwing and stuff like Alfred and stuff like the Outsiders and the Justice League, the fact that, you know, Batman has been part of this, you know, quote-unquote army building over time, he makes it all make sense, and at the same time sort of rejects that idea of Batman as the grim lone Avenger, because he hasn't been. You know, the evidence isn't there for it. And I think that's really cool. And again, it's, you know, you can do stories about Batman as a grim lone Avenger, and they can be great. And you can do stories about Batman as a member of the Justice League, and they can be great. And you can do stories about Batman as a guy who has, you know, a teen sidekick and a girl sidekick and a guy that he, you know, that he basically raised and was a father to, and has a butler who was basically a father to him, and has Jim Gordon, who's his, you know, friend and colleague. You can do stories with all of those elements. And I feel like for so long, Batman's been put in that box, and finally, you know, Grant Morrison is sort of spearheading getting him out of that.
Well, and when I say it's been earned, it's that, but it's also, you know, this has been, it's been building to this since 52.
Yeah, you know? And you know, that's when we got the, well, I'm gonna go do some stuff, and when I come back, I'm gonna be the lighthearted Batman.
Yeah,
and we just didn't realize it was gonna take 4 years.
Yeah, and so much of, you know, when a superhero character changes direction, or a writer comes on and says, I'm going to make this superhero, you know, different than you've ever seen him before. It's often just a hard shift that, you know, maybe a line or two explains, where the superhero just says, yeah, I needed a change. This, you can see exactly how Batman went from his old characterization to his new characterization. A course of several years of making that happen.
It works, you know, it works both metatextually and like within the story itself, that if you've been reading since 52 and 1 year later, which unsurprisingly I have, you can see Bruce Wayne go through all this stuff and sort of learn lessons that he hadn't learned before, which is really, really cool stuff, you know? And I liked it, you know, unsurprisingly, I loved it.
Yes.
And I'm really looking forward to more of Batman Inc.
The War Rocket Ajax reaction to Batman Inc., a big, big thumbs up.
Yeah.
And I think we both liked Batman the Return as well, even though not quite as much as Batman Inc.
Dave Finch, I don't think, was the guy to draw this comic. And I think that because they included script pages in the pack where Graham Morrison describes things that Dave Finch does not draw. But even so, you know, it was a nice transition between that last page of Return of Bruce Wayne that's, you know, very serious, that's very much, you know, Batman's going to go in there and fight some dudes, which he did in Batman and Robin 16, to the Batman who's okay with, you know, with Catwoman in her panties and leather boots sitting on his lap while he does his bench presses.
Yeah. And there's a lot of interesting setup for future stuff that's either going to come in Batman Inc. or maybe one of the other titles, setting up the whole plot with Leviathan and the Sheik, who, and there's like a betrayal and a few other things that maybe could have been a little bit clearer because of the art. But, you know, there's some interesting stuff about what Damian does in that issue and how it leads to Bruce basically saying he can't work with his son.
And that, which I like because they're so much alike.
Yeah. You know, there's a reference back to, it appears to be the last clone Batman from Batman 666. Even though that was not entirely clear who that character was that Damian went off and got distracted by. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting setup that hasn't exactly been paid off yet in any of the books yet. But, you know, this is Morrison, and it will be.
It's only been like 3 days. So.
Yeah.
I will say, this, like, the beginning of this issue totally encapsulates what I was talking about earlier, because we've got like 5 pages of narration about this bat, you know, the bat that flew through the window. And it's totally Grant Morrison doing Frank Miller.
Oh yeah. He calls it the old bastard bat.
Yeah. This old bastard bat was not yet ready to die. Not there, not then. And so you've got all this, you know, over the top Frank Miller stuff. And then he lands, Bruce Wayne sees him, he goes, that's it, rings a bell, and then the caption, which has been like this complete overblown Frank Miller dialogue, is suddenly, and so was born this weird figure of the night, which is a line from the original origin of Batman in Detective Comics 39.
Back to Bob Kane.
Yeah, well, back to Bill Finger. But yeah, it's, you know, it's totally Morrison sort of showing that you can take that stuff and then throw in everything else, which I really loved. The issue itself was, you know, a fun little adventure. It had some stuff that doesn't make sense at all. I did, like, Evie and Aaron from Awesome by Comics, our good friends, are way more critical of Morrison than I am. And then they especially sort of latch on to his weird dialogue peccadillos that he has, like when Batwoman talked about being dead, briefly dead before she was brought back by the Lazarus Pit, she described it as being on like being on a roller coaster in the dark, and they seized on that as being like just the laziest metaphor, which I thought it was okay, but I'm willing to give him that. The crazy stuff about Internet 3.0 and cheat codes. Just sounds like that was. I'm hoping it comes back. I'm hoping Morrison can save that line, because that was rough.
And they're being motorcycles in Internet 3.0.
Yeah, it's like apparently in the DC universe, Internet is going to be Tron.
Well, how else are you going to have Barbara Gordon as Batgirl again, unless it's in Tron?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like the idea of getting the occasional Barbara Gordon story where she's Batgirl in the Internet, like a virtual Batgirl. Yeah. I think that's cool. I just, you know, the way that it's presented in this is just ridiculous.
Well, and also Batman just going, Internet 3.0 is coming because we're inventing it. get on it, Barbara.
Yeah, have some cheat codes and vehicles and weapons. But I love that Barbara's reaction is Internet 3.0. You know, she's going to be like, do you mean Xbox?
Which is what every reader was asking too.
Yeah, and then the next panel is, what is this?
Yeah.
Which I, you know, again, I don't know if it's Morrison being self-aware that that sounds crazy, or if Bruce Wayne is just kind of going off on this weird tangent.
Yeah.
I do kind of like the idea that Bruce Wayne doesn't necessarily understand the internet, but I know that's not what the point is here.
Yeah. All right. I think that covers us for our requisite 20-plus minutes of talk about Batman.
And every episode.
Maybe now we should move on to some listener questions. What do you think, Chris?
Let's do it. All right. Our first question for this episode comes from Mr. Matt Fraction, who is, of course, our first guest on the show ever. And he wants to know where Huge is. And so I called up Huge on my cell phone, and I've got him on speaker right now. So, Huge, where are you? And is it true that you have 100 shows?
During last weekend, I have 9 shows from last weekend through the middle of December, which is why I had to turn the recording duties over to Mr. Matt Wilson, and which is why I'm not going to even be in a place, in one place, more than a couple days at a time from December 1st through 2011. So that's why I am taking a quick leave. I'm going to come back and do a proper farewell episode, but I booked shows a lot quicker than I thought I would. And I have to get the hell out of town so I know when I'm done to edit shows in the next couple weeks.
All right, well, to our good friend Matt Fraction and to all the fans of Huge, that's where Huge is. So that's all we needed, Huge. We just wanted to hear you say it. You go back to sleep, and we're going to answer the rest of these listener questions.
Thanks, Huge.
Ajax forever, Huge. I'll
yes.
Catch you later.
Thank you, Huge. I think we can count 9 shows as 100.
9's pretty close to 100.
Yeah, it's basically
between now and the middle of December. That's a lot of shows.
Yes. To anyone wondering, now that the answer of where Huge is has been thrown out,
I think the next logical question is, what the hell are you doing here?
Yeah, who the hell am I and what am I doing here? And briefly, you've probably heard me on the show before. I've been third chair several times. I used to run a website called the International Society of Supervillains. That is one way that Chris and I kind of knew each other. But even before that, we both were contributing editors to the 4-issue short-lived run of Cracked magazine, which we did through a mutual friend named Jay Pinkerton, who was a fan of Chris's blog and who I met through his message board via his comedy website. I was the mod of his comics section of that message board and participated in a lot of the Photoshop contests and stuff he had on there. He eventually became the editor of Cracked during the period that they had a magazine. Chris and I were both working there kind of at the same time, even though we never really worked together. And that's how we kind of became aware of each other, started reading each other's comedy and stuff on the internet. And hey, now we're hosting a podcast together.
Yep. I mean, that's basically it. We've been online friends for a while, again, since the Crack days, which would have been like 2006.
2007, something like that.
It's 8 good months. It was a biweekly magazine.
Yeah.
And we, you know, met in person, as I do with so many of my friends, for the first time at a comic book convention. And we've been, you know, we get along because we're so similar. So there will be now, instead of two disparate voices, there will now only be one unified voice of a white guy raised in the South who loves Batman, which is how it should be.
Yeah, 100%.
But
I'm just Chris 2, you know, and I'm sure that's what you guys want. And if you don't want it, fuck you. So
yeah, it's my show, so it's what I want, not what you want. So let's move on to some more questions from more listeners.
Okay.
Our next question comes from the original War Rocket Ajax power listener, Sean Hollenhorse, who wants to know, what is the official War Rocket Ajax stance on Captain Marvel? And that's Captain Marvel, the Fawcett character, not the Gil Kane, Jim Starlin Marvel character, Captain Marvel. What do you think, Matt?
I have not read nearly enough comics with Captain Marvel in them. That's something I need to rectify, because I hear the comic by the creator of Bone with Captain Marvel is really good.
It is good. It's not. I do not love it as much as everybody else loves it, because I feel like it's a little too on the nose. I would like to see, you know, just straight up Captain Marvel stories like they were in the Golden Age, where they're just like ridiculous and over the top, and he hangs out with a talking tiger. Because I feel like, you know, that would be perfect. And I would like it to be an all ages book, but not, you know, not one that was so directed at kids. Like, you know, again, I wish it was done exactly like it was in the Golden Age, because I think that would be really fun. And that would, it would just be left alone, and maybe occasionally he would race Superman.
I thought Captain Marvel, when he was made appearances on the Justice League cartoon series, was really awesome, though.
That was really awesome.
One step below the question as the most awesome character to be on that show. So
I watched Brave and the Bold tonight, and the cold open on Brave and the Bold was the question on Apocalypse, like looking up Darkseid's plans to unleash anti-life on the world. And I was like, oh, now come on, how did the question get to Apocalypse? But then I realized that was a silly question.
That is a silly question, Chris.
All right, our next question is, we actually have three really good questions from Hey, This Is Brian. So the first one is, only because I don't think one is a true War Rocket Ajax host until they've answered this classic, who is the sexiest Disney princess?
Little Mermaid.
Which is weird, because I don't remember answering this question.
It's the Little Mermaid.
Really? You were just going to go straight to Little Mermaid?
Yep.
To Ariel?
Yep.
Why?
Something about that clamshell bra, man.
She is the most scantily clad of the Disney princesses.
I mean, I guess I'm really showing my true colors here. But, yeah. It's got to be
fish ladies.
Well, exactly. Although I often wonder why they can't have the fish part on the top and the lady part on the bottom.
Yeah, like the speed with which you answered that has really put me on the spot now. I don't know, like Little Mermaid, she's all right. Jasmine, I like Jasmine. Again, okay. She's probably the one that is the second most scantily clad. She's kind of foxy. She's got those blue harem pants are hard to pull off.
You know, as long as neither of us picks Nala from The Lion King, I think we're okay.
Nala and Alice are the ones that I think are off limits. next question says, again, from Hey, This Is Brian, what webcomics do you follow?
Well, I think we both follow the various agreeable comics written by Kevin Church and drawn by various amazing artists, including Benjamin Birdie and T.J. Kirsch and Ming Doyle. All
Tracy
of those
Malk.
Are very good. Tracy Malk. All of those comics are really good and ought to be read. Awesome Hospital, Monster Plus, putting in some plugs for the Action Age there. Dinosaur Comics, Nedroid, Kate Beaton's Hark a Vagrant. What are some other ones, Chris?
Akewood. Akewood is, of course,
obviously
the king of webcomics. There have been like two Akewood strips in a row that have not finished up the plot. Like, we still don't know what happened to Teodor in the back of the van. But they've been really good, so it's hard to complain.
Yeah, the only thing about Akewood is that it updates so infrequently now, and not that I can, you know, blame Chris Onstad for that. I'm sure he's got lots of other things going on. But it updates so infrequently now that I occasionally forget about it, which is the worst thing I can do. But when I remember it, it's like my favorite webcomic, so...
Yeah, it's one that I can just like click on random strip and just read from wherever I end up. It's such a good comic. Dr. McNinja is another good one. I am a really big fan of Order of the Stick, which I feel it sort of requires a little bit of D&D knowledge, so I don't think it's for everyone. But once you get past that, there's just really, really strong character work and really good gags. Especially for it being a stick figure comic. Highly, highly enjoyable. Final question from Hey, This Is Brian says, this is for you, Matt. He says, Chris has a no Star Wars rule. Huge has never seen an episode of Doctor Who. What sci-fi franchise do you ignore?
I don't know if this is considered sci-fi. It's probably more in the category of fantasy, but I have never read a Harry Potter book. And I have never seen a Harry Potter movie.
Ooh, I did not know that when we got you to be the new co-host. That's going to make a problem.
Yeah. And it's not out of any feeling of distaste or dislike toward Harry Potter. I just kind of missed it. I just kind of missed the Harry Potter train.
You mean the Hogwarts Express?
That's correct.
You're never too old to be taken to a world of magic.
That's true. Maybe I need to catch up on Harry Potter.
Next question is from Phil Tackman, who says, now that there has been a year one for Batman and Scooby-Doo, what other pop cultural year ones would you like to see?
Eastbound and Down.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
That is a good one. I don't think I can top that one.
Kenny Powers year one.
Year fucking one.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, most of the stuff that I would go to has had its year one. I would kind of like to see more of Scott Pilgrim in high school.
Oh, that would be awesome.
That was one of my favorite parts of the graphic novels. But the volume 6 sort of puts the kibosh on that one.
Yeah.
So Simon the Digger says, what is your favorite kind of pudding?
I got to think about that one for a second, Chris. You need to field that first.
Depending on how loosely you define pudding, I enjoy flan, and I also enjoy creme brulee, which I believe are loosely related to the pudding family. Just straight up pudding-wise, I enjoy chocolate and also rice pudding.
Yeah, frankly, the only kind of like actual pudding that I've really eaten very much of it all is just the chocolate pudding in the snack cups. So I guess that, because banana pudding, it's banana pudding. It dawned on me just now. If we couldn't make this episode any banana more pudding. Southern, banana pudding.
I ate barbecue today and I didn't even think about banana pudding, but yeah, it's, but you have to like banana pudding. You can't have with just any meal. Like you have to have a southern meal.
And banana pudding is not just pudding. It's pudding with chunks of bananas in it and
wafers.
Vanilla wafers are key. So
the key. Next question comes from Chip Zdarsky, who says, what's the next comic to be turned into a big budget poem if you were in charge of stuff?
A big budget poem. Okay, Chris, you can take this one first.
The Rime of the Ancient Superman. Is what I would do with.
Oh, surfer, my surfer.
Greg Pak would like to know, what is the difference between hit dice and hit points? and I can explain that one if you're not up to it.
Okay.
All right. Well, you see, Greg, hit dice are how hit points are determined. For example, a 7-hit die monster would generally roll 7d8s or 8-sided dice to determine its hit points. It's essentially the equivalent for a monster of levels to a player character.
Well said, Chris. Well said.
Oh man, we should end it there because that pretty much kills the momentum of the show. But we do have a couple other good questions. Our good friend David Wolkin would like to know, the Spice Girls are a superhero team. Please assign powers to them. And which British boy band would contain their respective nemeses?
Well, okay. I guess we'll assign powers first.
I think Baby Spice would have, like, Black Canary's shrill canary cry.
Okay. I think Scary Spice needs to be able to mold her face into just demon-like, frightening faces that just completely paralyze and incapacitate anyone who approaches her.
To live up to her name.
Yeah.
I never really got why she was Scary Spice. She's not very scary.
You know, sometimes the person you see in public isn't the person you know in private, Chris.
Sporty Spice, super speed.
Yeah. Ginger Spice, you know, just an amazing power of seduction.
Word.
And then Posh Spice, just the incredible power to not care.
I was going to go with robots, like robot parts, but I think that works too.
Or just her Beckham that she can sick on anybody. And obviously the British boy band has to be Take That. Only one I can think of.
I don't really know too much about British boy bands. I think a good set of nemeses for the Spice Girls would be Oasis.
Oh, that would be good.
Just how great would it be if the fucking Gallagher brothers had superpowers? Like, they had superpowers and they hated each other.
You know, that is a much better answer than Take That, and I think that is the direction we're going to have to go in.
All right, and our the final question I'm going to ask, because I know we're running well over time at this point, is from D-Bed, who wants to know, NWO or DX?
Man, they were both hilarious. But I gotta say, at the time that they concurrently existed, I watched Nitro a lot more and was way more into the NWO storyline. So I'm gonna say NWO.
See, I am gonna go with DX. DX was made for far more enjoyable television and did not wear out their welcome nearly as quickly.
Yeah, by the time Sting was part of the Red NWO.
The Wolfpack.
The Wolfpack. And there was the competing heel NWO that was
Hollywood.
The Hollywood faction. Yeah, that took it way too far. But in the first days of the NWO, when they would like constantly interrupt the show with their little
Kick Tony Schiavone out of the broadcast booth.
Yeah.
That was good.
That was incredible stuff. But again, I was way into that.
DX invaded Turner, like invaded the Turner building in Atlanta.
Yeah,
and drove a tank up to an arena that was doing Nitro. That was hilarious.
That is a Sophie's Choice right there.
That's what won the Monday Night Wars, was when DX invaded Nitro and got people on TV saying that they got their tickets for free.
Yeah.
And with that, listener questions. And that's about all we have for this week. We are taking next week off for Thanksgiving, so happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Drive safely if you're on the road. If you're listening to this on the road, drive even more safely. But thank you all for listening. If you'd like to find out more about the show, again, warrocketajax.com, warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/theisb. That's T-H-E-I-S-B. You can find most everything I write at the-isb.com. You can find my webcomic at awesomehospital.com, updated every Tuesday and Thursday, except obviously this Thursday. We don't update on Thanksgiving. But next week, we are kicking off a big story that will be drawn and plotted by Matt Diggs, with a lot of dialogue by Diggs, too, who I am convinced is going to fire me and Chad. But we think you guys are going to really like this one before we get into our next big arc, which is going to be called Awesome Hospital Forever. You can check out comicsalliance.com, where I post twice a day, usually one big post and then one smaller post. But every Monday, I write up the week's episode of Smallville, which I watch so that you don't have to. And I think that's about all where you can find me. Oh! Except my huge announcement that I didn't make at the top of the show that I totally should have made during Check Yourself. I'll talk about it more next week. Skull Kickers number 6 comes out in February, will be solicited in December. I've got 6 pages in there, a 6-page story that I wrote, art by Joe Vrenz, I think is how you pronounce that. He's a great artist. I'm in there with Brian Clevenger of Atomic Robo, Ray Fox, who wrote Apocalypse 6, and Adam Warren, who needs no introduction. We'll talk about that more next week. Matt, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter. My Twitter name is HighMindedMW, which I considered changing to War Rocket Matt or something like that. But, you know, I've changed my Twitter name enough times. It's going to stay HighMindedMW. So you can follow me there. You can follow my other sort of satirical Twitter account at Fake E Etiquette. That's 3 E's in a row in the middle there. You should also follow our former co-host, transitioning co-host, Eugene, at Huge War Rock on Twitter. And that's about it.
All right. And, of course, you can also find Rusty Shackles at Rusty_Shackles and our good friend Max Huffman at twitter.com/Max Huffman, moctopus.com, yourfriendmax.com. And that's about it. No show next week, but when we come back, very special show, one of our first ever non-comics guests. We're going to have a guest who doesn't read comics at all, and we will have a little bit more information about him as it progresses. But see if you can guess who it's going
to
be.
Will we have anything to say to him? Let's find out. And
what are,
so,
are your Twitter questions going to be asked? We'll discover.
So that's it. War Rocket Ajax 48.
That's it, everybody. Good night. Ajax out.
Yeah! Flash.
All right, Chris, what have you been up to, listening to, reading, that you want to recommend to our listeners?
You're already screwing up, Wilson.
I'm drunk as fuck. Okay.